For over 10 years, Josh Hallmark has been trying to identify the unknown victims of methodical serial killer Israel Keyes. And now, he's joined by Joshua and Dakota, who are out in the field tracking down Keyes' hidden kill kits and caches. Somewhere in the Pines is brought to you by Studio Both and follows Joshua and Dakota into the woods of North America as they search for the caches and clues of Israel Keyes. Somewhere in the Pines is adventure true crime and the perfect companion podcast to True Crime Bullshit. And I have it on good authority that the partnership between True Crime Bullshit and Somewhere in the Pines has already moved the investigation into Israel Keyes forward in ways it has never been before. Check out the first episode of Somewhere in the Pines now, then go subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Studio Both and collaboration.
Somewhere in the Pines is a serial podcast containing adult content, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, and suicide. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
In 2012, Alaskan law enforcement came face to face with one of this country's most prolific serial killers. His name is Israel Keyes.
Investigators say Israel Keyes had a so-called murder kit. Keyes strategically hid a box filled with weapons and tools near the Winooski River.
There is a orange Home Depot bucket.
Inside would be a gun, weapons, a rope, zip ties.
He always flew somewhere, rented a car, and then drove hundreds, if not 1,000 miles.
Well, he told investigators he left the kits in Washington State, Wyoming, and Texas, and planned to hide one in Arizona.
He was in a whole bunch of states. I mean, Alaska, Vermont, Washington, Oregon, New York, New Jersey, California, Texas, Illinois, Tennessee.
Do you have a cache in Washington? Is there a death buried in Washington?
All right.
When I was a kid, I always used to dream that I'd find buried treasure, and I figured, well, if I can't find it, I might as well create it.
A.M. I stumble around the house, gathering the remaining items for our trip. My list includes batteries, chargers, triple check all mics, cables, and recorder are in the recording bag, toothbrush, cooler, and computer. Juniper, a kettle dog mix, attempts to convince me it's time to eat, while Harriet, a lab mix, glances at me from her dog bed. I'm already behind schedule. Packing the night before took much longer than I anticipated, forcing me to wake up at the latest possible moment and still make it to Dakota's on time. It's just over an hour drive to the Portland metro area, where we'll meet at his house and then drive nearly 300 miles north to spend another 3 days in the Olympic wilderness. It's a cold and unusually dry morning along the Upper Nehalem River in the small logging town of Vernonia, Oregon. With a population of just over 2,000 people, it is not dissimilar from the locations we will soon be searching in hopes of finding a missing link to the victims and crimes of Israel Keyes. As I drive the winding roads of Columbia County, I attempt to put myself in the mind of the lesser-known yet terrifying serial killer. Imagining what Keyes would be thinking when choosing a set of locations to abduct, murder, and dispose of his victims. What did he look for when he buried his cache of weapons and stashed his disposal equipment? His shovel, plastic bags, and jugs of Drano months, if not years, in advance. This has been one of the hardest parts of working on this project. Allowing myself to envision the process through the lens of the most meticulous serial killer ever caught. A man dedicated to hiding in plain sight. You start to look at every location with a sinister point of view. Suddenly every place you stop, every roadside pull-off, every small secluded park or abandoned house becomes a place of horrific possibilities.
It was easy for Joshua and I to get pulled deep into this mystery. We'd been spurred into action, enticed by adventure, hoping to one day find tangible evidence that could bring answers to a victim's family. I feel like the forests and rivers are calling to us as we've spent countless hours researching this case, poring over maps, conversing about the FBI interrogations, hoping we can sift out a lead that will show us where to go. Like a fishing trip with my brother or a road trip with my dad, I'm up early in preparation, but feeling anxious. What are we doing? Is there even anything out there? Could it possibly still be there after all these years? And even if it is, how in the world are we going to find it? My wife and kids still asleep in their beds as I gather my gear. Josh will be here soon.
About a half mile out from Dakota's house. How you doing?
Good, man.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Get some sleep last night?
Yeah, I went to bed pretty early. Yeah. But I was a little rowdy, just couldn't sleep.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you need a hand with anything?
No, I'm gonna grab the computer and just all the equipment and everything.
Did you run over my ladder?
No, it was really close though.
Yeah, it was close.
Yeah, if you want to grab the recorder.
On the other side?
I'll bring it up to you right here. Good. Yeah, this is pretty much it. I'm just gonna double check and then lock up my truck.
All right, I'll just go say bye and wake Jess up.
Cool.
Give me a hug, bud. I gotta go.
I love you. Oh, do good in school. I'll see you in a couple of days, okay?
Well, I want hugs from you, too.
That morning in 2022, we packed our equipment into the car to make the almost 6-hour drive to the top of Washington's Olympic Peninsula. Josh and I have been friends for almost 20 years. We've toured internationally as musicians, worked for the same construction company for almost a decade, and more recently played a ton of hockey together. Today, we're going to hunt for the hidden caches of Israel Keyes. You might ask, who is Israel Keyes, or what in the world is a cache? We'll do our best to explain.
All right.
All good?
Is that a half gallon of hand sanitizer? Good.
Want to use my car? Are you guys saving these masks?
Yeah. Oh, you're going to want to use some of that hand sanitizer after you throw those away.
Okay. That's why I got it. Where do you want the, where's the good spot?
Right over there.
Holy shit.
What was that?
Some slick mud right there.
Yeah, dude.
Almost toppled right to the ground.
Great way to start.
Israel Keyes was a devoted outdoorsman, a soldier, and a father. He was also an admitted arsonist, rapist, bank robber, and murderer. Torturing and killing people, you could say, was Israel's passion. This season, you will hear the story of two friends following the trail of a serial killer that has long gone cold. Searching for new evidence and answers to questions investigators and the FBI have been asking for over a decade. In this podcast, we will examine the methods and tactics he employed to locate Israel's caches of weapons, tools, and keepsakes hidden all around the country. I'm Dakota.
And I'm Joshua. Welcome to Somewhere in the Pines, Season 1, The Peninsula.
Take all you can into your body. Shelter from your eyes. I'm keeping my calm. Down for a safe engage. You may never see light again.
Washington was a lot easier in a lot of ways because once I lived out in Nia Bay, I knew all of Washington pretty well, and except I was so isolated out there. Once you drive past Port Angeles, it's like you're in a new world anyway. So. Mm-hmm.
What's that whole part? There's a whole set of mountains right there, right? That separates Nia Bay from...
Yeah, the Olympic... Well, there's mountains everywhere out there. But...
The Olympic Peninsula. A hauntingly beautiful landscape that occupies the northwesternmost corner of the contiguous United States. More specifically, a 3,600 square mile area of rugged Pacific Ocean coastline, jagged glacier-capped mountains, and deafeningly silent old-growth rainforests. A stark contrast to the industrial skyline of its Puget Sound neighbor, Seattle, Washington, the Olympic Mountain Range is dominated by coniferous forests, not brick and mortar.
Okay, swim, check, check, swim. Visitor Center. All
right. On our first search of the area, three ring binders and probably too much audio equipment in hand, we stopped by the Swim Visitor Center to check up on a few specific locations we were having trouble finding on our maps. They're looking out like, oh, I got a couple of douchebags in my head. Need a mask?
I'll probably ask them if they prefer it or not. My general rule is if they're wearing a mask, I throw one on.
I'll just throw it on anyways.
Yeah.
How's it going?
Hi. How are you doing?
We're doing fine. How can we help you?
We asked the host, whose sweater, glasses, and earrings all match the turquoise green color of our eyes, to describe the region. We wanted to get a better feel of the area from someone who's spent so much time there.
Fell in love with the friendliness, the slower pace of life, the scenery you can't beat.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you've got the mountains and the snow and you've got the ocean. I can see it might be a little more of a problem for younger people because there's not the social life as much here.
Mm.
But those that like the outdoor and hunting and fishing and hiking and kayaking, it's a perfect place.
In 2001, after being honorably discharged from the Army at the age of 23, Israel Keyes moved to Washington's Olympic Peninsula. It would be his time living in this remote region of the U.S. that he would develop and hone in the multifaceted approach that would become his unique mode of operation. Keyes lived on the peninsula until 2007, but it was an area he visited often, even after he moved away.
Like I say, obviously you have no reason to trust me, but I can tell you right now, there is no one who knows me, or who has ever known me, who knows anything about me, really. They know they're going to tell you something that does not line up with anything I tell you because I'm two different people, basically. And the only person who knows about what I'm telling you, the kind of things I'm telling you, is me.
How long have you been two different people?
Long time. 14 years. Like I say, you got your monster. I'm the only one who knows about it. Don't go anywhere with strangers.
Israel Keyes admitted the physical and psychological torture of his victims was what drove him. Age didn't matter. Gender didn't either. He had no type. His victims were, as far as we can tell, random. The wrong place at the wrong time. He would employ a swift blitz attack, overwhelming a victim and taking complete control of them as fast as possible. He admitted to necrophilia, body dismemberment, mutilation and manipulation, sexual assault with restraints, and asphyxiation by cable tie.
Keyes was a sexual sadist, but it's the duality that makes him so terrifying and difficult to understand. For 14 years, he operated as two different people. He committed his crimes over a very short amount of time, within a span of a few hours, but the planning was years in advance, creating opportunities and alibis through efficiency, detail, and distance. If you were to ask anyone that knew Israel, they would tell you about a very different person. Nearly everyone that knew him had positive things to say about him. Israel's a great father, a fun drunk, he was well-adjusted, a model soldier. All quotes taken from the case file. It's this duality, the two completely different lives, that made Israel so dangerous to society, because he passed the smell test.
I've experienced this kind of duality firsthand. And there's a strange thing that happens when you find out that someone you know has committed a heinous act of violence. For me, in 2006, when I found out that someone I work closely with murdered, skinned, and dismembered his two roommates, I was unable to reconcile those actions with the person that I knew. Even after seeing him in the courtroom, sitting across from him in the witness box, I was unable to see that other person in him. As I left the stand and passed by him, he called out. With a wide smile and while playing air guitar, he wished me good luck on my tour. Dakota and I were about to go on a UK tour with our band. So even as he sat there, about to be found guilty of murder and be sentenced to life in prison, he still wanted me to remain fooled. I'd imagine when Israel Keyes was first arrested on March 13, 2012, the people in his orbit may have gone through some of the same emotions. How could he do it? How did I not see it? Were there signs that I missed? All of the questions that work their way into your mind, making you second-guess yourself, your judgment of character. But it's Israel who wears the badge of deceit. If you haven't witnessed the violence firsthand, it can be hard to truly believe that someone you cared about is capable of such atrocities. In complete contrast are the families of his victims who only see the evil. They are reminded every day by the absence of their loved ones.
You've talked before about you read a lot, and that's where you've gotten. You've read about a lot of other serial killers and reading about other, you know, crimes and that kind of stuff. Might be a weird question, but who's your favorite? We've talked about it, so we're kind of curious, and we're curious on who your favorite is.
Well, my favorite ones haven't been caught yet, so I guess I don't know
okay.
Any other names.
That's a fair question.
That's actually a good response. Okay, of the ones who have been caught that you've been able to read about, we'll see who was right or who was closest for us.
I don't know, if what I've read about them is accurate, I don't feel that close to any of them. So I guess I identify most, or my favorite, if you have to put it that way, would be the ones that I identify most with.
Yeah,
so,
that's a fair way to say it.
I don't know, maybe just going off of what I've read, Ted Bundy maybe. I don't have a lot of respect for someone because of the way they lived, I guess. Like I say, at first I was pretty conflicted about it, but that was all just because of the way I'd been raised and stuff. And you know, I grew up with good people. I was never, you know, everybody's always nice to each other and everything's all sunshine and roses. And so that's why it was disturbing to me, because it seemed like for a long time I either thought everybody else was faking it and everybody was like me, they just didn't act like it. Or I figured that I was... demon child or whatever, I don't know. But, I mean, all that went away when I was in my 20s. I didn't feel bad about it anymore.
You didn't feel bad that you were that you had those thoughts?
I knew that most people didn't think the way I did by then. I just didn't feel bad about thinking differently at that time. I
just kind of accepted that that's who you were and that's...
Yeah, I just...
Did you know? So you said Ted Bundy. You kind of felt like maybe you had some things, and you know, or at least in common with or something. Do you know stuff about him? Do you study?
I know that he had a lot of. He was very sexually motivated in the stuff that he did, and I know that
in the last few years, he had a really hard time controlling himself and separating his two lives, if you want to call it that. And I also identified with him because it seemed like he was able to separate his two different aspects, or whatever you want to call them, his personality.
Israel claimed the person he related to the most might have been Ted Bundy, similar in their sadistic desires and lack of empathy, but the duality is the part that Israel focused on. This is Ted Bundy speaking to Dr. James Dobson the day before his scheduled execution.
I want people to understand this too, and I'm not saying this gratuitously because it's important people understand this, that basically I was a normal person. I wasn't some guy hanging out at bars or a bum, or I wasn't a pervert in the sense that, you know, people look at somebody and say, I know there's something wrong with him, and just tell. I mean, I was essentially a normal person. I had good friends. I led a normal life, except for this one small but very potent and very destructive segment of it that I kept very secret, very close to myself, and didn't let anybody know about it. And part of the shock and horror from my dear friends and family years ago when I was first arrested was that there was no clue. They looked at me and they looked at the all-American boy. And I mean, I wasn't perfect, but I want to be quite candid with you. I was okay. Okay. I was.
Both killers demonstrate total self-awareness when speaking of their duality and deceit. It was this awareness of deception that allowed both Bundy and Keyes to hide in plain sight for years without detection.
Alright, well...
Still not working?
No, there it goes. No, it's working now, so there's a good chance that nothing was recorded.
Yeah. it's hard to do stuff in the morning.
Yeah. I can't believe that.
Well, we'll get it next time.
Yep.
So, we are just west of Port Angeles. We drove up here. It's about noon on a Friday, just off Highway 112. And we are scouting out locations.
So it looks like we've got a lot of homes along this back edge. So it's a pretty thin slice of land right here. And it looks like on the map that all of this first section is private property with a really small barrier between from the trail to the actual private property. So I'd love to, you know, if we come out here tomorrow, to walk down through this just to kind of see if anything is
between the two.
Yeah. Yep.
The trail and the property lines.
Yeah. I mean, I think our best chance is to get into the power lines. It seems most likely like a better spot in my opinion, but
right.
It'd be easy to walk this.
You take a lot of chances hiding something this close to someone's house. So I looked up that bucket handle, why it wasn't reading.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And it's because, metal detectors have a really hard time reading stainless steel, that any kind of metal with a low electrical conductivity, it doesn't read as well or at all. Hmm. And especially if it has like a coating of zinc on it, which those things do.
Yeah.
So the bucket handles might not be our best target.
No shit. Well, what about the guns, though?
A cache is a collection of items of the same type stored in a hidden or inaccessible place. Survivalists commonly cache supplies such as food, guns, ammunition, and other survival gear. Israel Keyes is categorized as an organized offender. He is often referred to as the most meticulous serial killer because of the extreme levels of planning he took to commit murder, sometimes hiding a cache of weapons years in advance and thousands of miles from home. The caches have sometimes been described as kill kits or rape kits, but our research has shown that he had more than just one type of cache. This is extremely important to us because we've found that different caches get placed in different locations in relation to the crime. We believe that his caches can be broken into six variations. That doesn't necessarily mean we think he used six caches for every murder. We believe that he had different types of caches for different situations, and it was the overall plan that dictated the type of cache that he used. This will become more obvious as we begin to break down each specific cache type.
The most common cache style that is related to keys is a kill cache or kill kit. This cache typically contains guns and ammunition, knives, restraints, and items used in sexual assault. This is the cache that is the centerpiece of a future crime. After finding a location that suits Israel's checklist of requirements, he hides this in a spot that is easily accessible, but in a location that has low foot traffic. Second is a tool cache. This cache may not be used with every plan, and sometimes it can be combined with the kill cache or brought along the day of a planned crime. He described using these caches with cordless tools, chains, and locks that he could use to gain access to Forest Service roads, gated trailheads, and parking lots. Third is a disposal cache. This will have items like garbage bags, Drano, and a shovel. He has shown that if he plans to have his rental car nearby, he may just hide this in his trunk. But other times, he has been known to place this at a future disposal site so it can be there waiting for him and the victim. Fourth would be a money cache. Israel admitted to robbing homes, banks, and other establishments and storing the money from these robberies in caches, placed in a spot of convenience for a follow-up trip. Next, we believe there's evidence of Israel having a home base cache. These caches are more of a stockpile of weapons and a mixture of items used to build other caches when he finds an area that fits his criteria for murder. These items would be closer to home, easily accessible as well, but in a more remote location that has no immediate proximity to a planned crime. Final cache is the trophy cache. This will hold items from a murder that Israel wants to possess. It will have evidence of a past crime and will solely be used to fulfill his desire to control and relive his crimes. A cache that is hidden with the plan to never recover.
These caches are fluid. Sometimes combined for efficiency, sometimes brought along during his travels, and sometimes recycled and repurposed in a new location. The most important thing we realized is that the objects from a trophy cache are sometimes intermingled with the other caches for expediency, which means various caches contain evidence of previous crimes, including murder, which makes it possible that we can find actual physical evidence of unidentified victims.
How many caches are there?
In Washington?
Washington, United States, Canada.
The idea with the caches is to have something everywhere.
Yeah, there's lots of beer bottles, beer cans, caps, just general trash. Wait, this thing is just talking. This is reading 3 inches underground. Let's see if I can get down there. Go. Look at that. Horseshoe.
Seriously?
Huh?
You found a horseshoe?
Found a horseshoe.
Oh, that's awesome, man. It's good luck.
Good luck.
Jinx. Woo!
Of all the caches that Israel Keyes hid in various locations across the country, only two have ever been found, and they were recovered with help from Keyes himself. One was in Eagle River, Alaska, and the other at Blake Falls Reservoir in Parrishville, New York. He He also admitted to hiding numerous other caches in places such as Essex, Vermont, Green River, Wyoming, Southeast Texas, and Port Angeles, Washington. Every year that passes, every wildfire that rages, every flood that envelops the land, leaves us with a blurred image of what was 15 years ago.
I'll be dimming the light for takeoff, the cabin light. If you need additional lighting, just reach above your seat. Here's our reading light above your seat. Thank you.
Natural growth alone is enough to conceal what may have been an easily accessible cache years before.
Ladies and gentlemen, for the flight deck, permission line for departure. Flight attendants, please prepare for takeoff.
This season of Somewhere in the Pines, our search will take place on Washington's Olympic Peninsula. But to tell the story in order, we need to go back. Back to look at the location of a recovered cache. A cache that was used in at least 3 abductions, 3 murders, and at least 1 bank robbery. Join us in episode 2 as we go to Blake Falls Reservoir to get some perspective.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Somewhere in the Pines. One simple way for you to join the search is to rate and review the show. And don't forget to subscribe and tell a friend. For photos, videos, and more, visit somewhereinthepines.com.
Keeping the horseshoe because it's good luck.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system. So you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.